Fellow members, at the close of my last talk on creative processes, I was referring to the Gandharvas and the Devas of various orders, archangels and angels, who assist in the building of the cosmos. And now I'm going to attempt a description of the appearance of some of these wonderfully beautiful and powerful beings. Appropriate portrayal, as it were, by painting of the appearance of the creative gods is really impossible through the medium of paint applied to a plain surface. Colored fire, or fire moving in three dimensions, would be needed to produce the effect of intense brilliance, translucence, delicacy, and constant motion characteristic of the radiant forms and shining auras of the gods. The continual changes in the colors alone and in their arrangement, in the direction of the flow of the auric forces, and in the various patterns produced, sometimes wing-like in their shape, all this makes accuracy of both description and, of course, portrayal on canvas exceedingly difficult. Studying them, as I have for a great many years attempted to do, it would seem, and remember I am only sharing the ideas of one student, and admit to the possibility of limitation of both vision and description. But, thus observing, it has seemed to me that at least two different conditions of the auras of the creative intelligences are discernible. One is that of expansion, when the auras are spread out, and the other of contraction. In expansion, the attention is outward turned upon the divine life and mind in all nature. The aura is then greatly extended outward from the central form and frequently from behind in three-dimensional and wing-shaped radiations. In this phase, that's of expansion, you remember, in this phase the component forces are flowing at their full power, and this produces a great brilliance throughout the whole aura, and a dazzling brightness at the various force centers, chakras, or wheels. In the phase of contraction, it has seemed to me, the attention of the god is directed towards the source of all life and power. The aura then becomes relatively quiescent, and with the exception of the radiations above the head, which may increase in both dimension and brilliance, it is reduced in size. Whatever the phase, the texture or grain of the aura of a deva is exceedingly fine, and there are various layers of force within this aura, each with its own hues and directions of flow. The general effect, as one watches, is of brilliantly colored, three-dimensional, shot moire silk. And this is composed of flowing forces, of course, rather than substance, and is in constant wave-like motion. Very often, through this, from within outwards, streams of radiant energy, often pure white, of dazzling brightness, are constantly shooting and flashing. The direction of the flow of these auric currents is generally upwards and outwards from force centers, and these are in the middle of the head, at the brow, the throat, and the region of the solar plexus. Then, outlying the central form, there is also a fine radiation, usually white or golden in color, like molten gold, flowing continually over and outlining the human-like central form. The heads of the gods are nearly always crowned by upward-flowing, flame-like forces. These bestow upon the more highly evolved archangels an appearance of regal splendor. For the most part, the universal energies for which the gods are agents and directors, these seem to descend from above the head and flow through the aura, greatly increasing its electric quality and brilliance. Other energies from higher dimensions appear to arise directly within the body and the chakras, as if from an inner plane. Now it has appeared to me that one function of the gods is to transform, in the electrical sense, step down, you know, the voltage, to transform, in the electrical sense, the creative forces, and they do this by means of the resistance offered by their bodies and by the passage through their force centers. Two of the results produced by this stepping down procedure are the transmission of spiritualizing force into the substance of the lower planes of nature down to the physical, and the passing on of great currents of stepped down energy for the use of the angels and nature spirits in their various tasks upon the planes of form. Matter itself thus gradually becomes increasingly charged with spirit, and so more malleable and responsive to consciousness, and the forms of nature gradually in consequence resemble more and more nearly the archetypal ideal. According to occult philosophy, the superphysical worlds, which are the abodes of the gods, as you know, consist of matter of increasing tenuity of substance, ranging from the density of the finest ether up to the rarest and most spiritualized condition. In the formless worlds, where auras predominate over the appearance of forms, the archangels and angels appear as glowing centers of power, surrounded by outflowing energies of many hues, almost veiling the faint, human-like form within. But when you come to the mental and astral planes, and the etheric, where the little nature spirits operate, there the suggestion of bodily shape is greater. Though here also the shining aura frequently conceals the lordly and beautiful form. Now, applying this to our studies and to the attempted clairvoyant observation of the process of the emission of the creative word, a tremendous power at the highest levels, of course, and its stepping down through the hierarchies of the angels, it has seemed to me that the whole canopy of heaven, the limitless hemisphere of visible space in the higher consciousness, is filled with great choirs of angels. Now, you know, even whilst I'm talking like this and using these words, I know that I am failing to convey the reality and am at best materializing the concept, but I can't help it. If you'll remember that, then let me go on freely to share with you my thoughts on this great subject of creation. To me, in the inner worlds, there appears to be a vast orchestra and choir of angels, filling all space, gathered, if you might say, and again materializing the concept, gathered in tiers or rows, as it were, arranged in groups, each with its own characteristics, colors, tones, and chanting the great cosmic mantras of creation. Every atom of the auras of these great beings is glowing, shining, self-radiant with the appropriate hues of their particular chord of existence. And so the space all around them is also shimmering with the iridescent radiance of their auras and the effects of their songs, if I might so call them, upon the surrounding elemental essence or free matter of the different planes. Vast areas, differently colored, fill all space, and in them countless myriads of winged faces and shining beings are, I think, to be seen. One mighty, inconceivably glorious power, a Mahagandharva, as it were, whose aura encloses, fills, and energizes them all, and whose consciousness, like that of a conductor, keeps them all absolutely in one. Such a being appears to preside over these interior formative activities. As I've watched with my very limited capacities, it has seemed to me that order after order, color after color, chord after chord, constantly sound, resound, and echo forth the music of the creative word which we've been studying together. Invisible in higher, unattainable realms, there must be conceived the one divine singer of all, who forever conceives and chants his word from dawn to eve. If the mind of the observer is allowed to roam and the consciousness really lets itself go, then human ideas obtrude themselves into that higher world so that these beings do actually seem, and it's only seem, please remember, to be playing on musical instruments. And I feel that some of the great artists, whether of the old pictures of the Gandharvas in Oriental religious art, or are of the same concept amongst the great masters of the Western world, there we see these creative gods portrayed as playing on musical instruments. Some of these resemble long funnels, like celestial trumpets, as if held between the lips of the Gandharvas, and a concentrated flow of sound rushes down them in clarion tones. Others of the great angels of music, the choirs in part of the choral orchestra, orchestras of the great symphony of creation seem to sing with their mouths, and one can thus see why the great painters of old, catching glimpses of these inner worlds of beauty and truth, portrayed certain orders of angels with colored robes, colored wings, and musical instruments. In truth, when one attempts to bring these great causal, formless concepts down to the level of the formal mind, they do tend to become shaped into familiar, concrete forms. admittedly, the truly scientific investigator and explorer into these regions must resist this tendency, and the consciousness maintained in the untranslatable and incommunicable reality of those higher worlds, wherein choirs of angels, if I may repeat it, ever chant and perform the great symphony of creation. May I go on? Very well, let me do so, for I am sharing with you the fruits of my own long-continued studies and attempted explorations into these processes of the creation of universes. For example, it has seemed that the majestic music, expressive of the divine idea, descends from those lofty realms to the lower worlds of form, the Rupa planes. Now there, you see, I've been speaking diagrammatically, and whilst truly from that point of view, actually quite wrong. The planes of nature aren't arranged in strata like the rungs of a ladder or the strata of the mineral rocks. On the contrary, they all occupy the same space and interpenetrate, though the finer planes extend far beyond the denser one. But really we should think of this emanation of creative power, voice and song and music, as from a center deep within at the plane of Adi, outwards rather than from above. Will you please remember that? Then I can say, diagrammatically then, that the majestic music, expressive of the divine idea, coming from the creative voice, descends diagrammatically from the inner worlds into the lower worlds, the outer worlds of form, the Rupa planes. There the appropriate angels, Rupa angels we call them, those of the mental and astral planes, receive and re-echo the voice and the music until it is heard at the lower levels, the astral level, for example, and begins to influence elemental essence there. Again it is re-echoed, again it is stepped down or slowed down by passage through the mind and auras of the gods until at last it reaches the etheric world and causes etheric matter, nature's womb, as I said in an earlier talk, to begin to assume shapes, patterns, beautiful designs, expressive in form of the one formless archetype. As a result, magnetic fields of force containing geometrical designs are set up, as can be seen if you experiment with sand stretched on a membrane and make the membrane vibrate to certain sounds. You will see that those vibrations tend to produce geometrical patterns, fields of force, lines of least resistance, which causes the sand to settle down in geometrical form. And it's these I have come to believe. These are the fields of force along which physical nature builds the shining garment of the Supreme. So you see, we've now brought the whole idea from those fundamental principles which we earlier have studied together right down through the planes, and here we are at last, considering the process of the building of nature's forms. Here, the elementals, as they are called, the nature spirits, perform their part, even if quite unconsciously, simply in a spirit of enjoyment, ecstasy. For the nature spirits of earth, particularly of earth and air, play in these lines of force. And this has an effect. It increases the formative tendency of the magnetic energies and assists in the building, atom by atom, molecule by molecule, and cell by cell, as I've been saying, of nature's physical forms. Thus, right down here at the etheric level, the hierarchies of creative intelligences are represented by the minor builders of form, the little artists, dancers and singers, if you like, the nature spirits, the sephiroths in miniature, the creative intelligences in the becoming, who are beginning their ascent of their ladder of evolutionary life. For you know, the nature spirits are the younger brethren of the angels, and the angels in their turn have their seniors high above them, and so on to the great archangels of godlike power and beauty. And these little nature spirits then operate instinctually. They don't know what they're doing at all. You know, when I was making these observations, it took me years to find this out. So slowly did my mind operate. I used to try and talk to the nature spirits and ask them what it was they thought they were doing. Dancing about in rings and cross, somewhat like the lancers or the quadrilles, floating up into the air in hemispherical or spherical order, and swinging about throughout nature's forms in forests and fields, I found when I asked them that they didn't know themselves. They were simply instinctually responding to the divine song, or if you like, the play of the divine creative energies and the patterns they produce. And so the nature spirits operate instinctively. They don't know actually what they're doing. They're simply playing and dancing along the lines of force. But you know, when they put themselves in a certain current of electromagnetic and creative energy, they find these streams of force very stimulating, electrifying, even intoxicating to them. And so they dance along the lines of force, keeping within them, keeping within the particular lines of the geometrical pattern set up in the all-pervasive ether by the emitted and vibrating word force, which we have been studying. And all this is happening, don't forget, within nature. We mustn't think of these hierarchies as being objectively outside. They're not. They're within the descending stream of the resonating, thought-imbued life force itself. And all the work is done from within the outflowing, emanating streams of creative power. The laboratory of nature and its engineers, chemists, artists and craftsmen, great and small, they're all within physical substance. Somewhat as radio waves are transmitted through and within the air, and an electrical current goes along a wire. Both basic substance and protoplasm are charged from within by an indwelling force, a directive, creative, formative life force, God within, God immanent, the omnipresent Logos, who is the creator, sustainer, and transformer of all that exists, and the spiritual parent of all the monads that come forth into the universe, or radiate forth into the field for their evolution. Now let us look at this even more closely, shall we? Let us move on to the physical plant kingdom of nature and try to understand a little of the mystery which is taking place there. Similar creative processes are occurring throughout the organic kingdoms of nature. Here again, the problem facing the biologists and others is profound. They admit that chemical characteristics alone do not constitute living organic material. They cannot just put the chemicals together and produce a living thing, though they are trying to do so and seem to be coming very near it even in this last year or two. There is, however, another factor which ever eludes the scientist with his physical instruments thus far, and doubtless will continue to do so long as scientific research is limited to physical senses and instruments. Perhaps the time will come when the scientist is also a yogi and an occultist, like the great masters of the wisdom are. Then the scientist will be able to see behind the veil that hidden life, force, energy, able to hear that song which constitute together the missing link in our present knowledge. Even now it is admitted that life is present, though it has hitherto eluded scientific observation. An active, organizing agency admittedly is there, in cell, in nucleus, in germ point. It's invisible, but it coordinates the various processes of an organism, and these processes of biological organization lead to the development of form, such as progression from a fertilized seed or egg to an adult plant or animal. As yet, apart from the occult scientists, these processes are a profound enigma. Some of the machinery is known. The genes and the chromosomes, and now DNA, which you may have read, the complex arrangement of amino acids and other proteins which control development, these are being seen and studied and known to step into the process at the right time and place. But the emergence of the form of a body from a fertilized seed admittedly demands the operation of a designing, coordinating mind, for regulatory activity is shown in all types of biological organization. This can admittedly be watched physically to some extent, rising in a series of orderly steps, right from the mysterious substance known as protoplasm, on through to the cell, which in its turn contains the potentiality and energy from which the whole organism will appear. Now what has theosophy to say, finally, in the solution of this mystery? Well, we've been studying it together. There is an indwelling, universal, directive intelligence which controls all the processes of formation, creation, and so the processes of generation and regeneration at all stages of growth. At every phase of evolutionary development, the divine mind is there as a coordinating influence, causing all changes and developments to occur according to the pattern on the mount, the divine archetype. And this is produced established as a function of protoplasm by the agency of the emitted, form-producing word force, which we've been studying rather deeply together in these talks. For occult science, you know, and this is important also to remember, occult science that teaches that nothing which exists is truly inanimate. Life is present in everything, in the mineral. Yes, even in ashes, for example, which seem to be about the deadest thing one can observe. Life is present in the mineral, in the ash, as in all other forms. All germs and all seeds are ensouled by a vital energy, are imbued with force, are resounding with the music of the divine voice, or if you like, the word. And these, the vital energy, the creative force, and the creative sound, these together cause the seeds to germinate and grow into the forms of their particular species. And there I must bring my study with you to a close, and finally we'll just go back to certain of the principles with which Theosophy illumines us. One of these is that when we look upon nature's varied forms, her metals, her jewels, her flowers, trees and forests, her rivers, lakes and falls, we are gazing indeed not only upon the materialized auras of the gods, as the Hindus say, but if, with all reverence we may say so, we are gazing upon a manifestation of God himself. For nature is but God revealed, God's dream made manifest by the continued utterance of his idea-charged word, made manifest by the chant of his own mighty name and the ceaseless, constructive, beautifying ministry of the greater and the lesser gods. And finally, one last repetition. Behind, beyond and within all nature, there exists that eternal and infinite parent from which the temporary and the finite are born. This is the boundless, self-existent absolute, the causeless cause, the rootless root. And as we've been studying together, from that capital THAT, that which can only be described as no thing to our senses and our consciousness. From that, the absolute, the rootless root, rhythmically and cyclically, creative intelligences emerge, conceive the idea, sound the word, and the new day of Manvantara dawns. Creation, or rather emanation, begins once more.